This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me David Suzuki, who's a huge celebrity in the best sense of the word in Canada, not very well known in the United States, I'm afraid, but he's a longtime host of the Canadian TV show The Nature of Things with David Suzuki. Think Ted Koppel on science and the environment. David Suzuki, who was chosen as one of the greatest Canadians by CBC, has a new book out. It's his autobiography, and I highly recommend it. David Suzuki, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I like the title of your first chapter, My Happy Childhood in Racist BC, British Columbia. How did the racism manifest itself?
Well, you know, as a child, you live in a bubble, a world that's very carefully protected by your parents, and I was totally unaware that I was any different from the kids in the neighborhood that I was playing around with. It's only as I got older, I became aware of what my parents had grown up under. Mom and Dad were born in Vancouver in the early 1900s. So I'm born in Vancouver. You know, English was the language that we spoke at home. I was a Canadian until Pearl Harbor. And even after Pearl Harbor happened, I was totally unaware of what the hell was going on. I mean, I was five. I didn't know there was a war going on. I didn't know that it involved people that I was identified with. Next thing you know, my dad's gone. He had volunteered to go to a camp, hoping that by his volunteering to go away, that his family would be left on the west coast of Vancouver. But of course, we were all swept up like everybody else. 22,000 Japanese Canadians basically shipped out.
You know, a lot of Americans don't understand that Canadians of Japanese ancestry were put into internment camps as well.
Well, I suspect that a lot of Americans don't know Japanese Americans were swept up and put in camps. It's one of those things. You know, I'm always amazed that Earl Warren was one of the guys I really admired as your Supreme Court, the head of the Supreme Court. Yet Earl Warren was a governor of California, and he never, ever apologized for signing the orders that led to the evacuation of Japanese-American citizens. It was a time of great fear, but, you know, now that I'm older and have spent time in the civil rights movement, you realize that, you know, when times are easy, you can guarantee all kinds of things, you know, equality before the law and freedom to associate and speak and all that stuff. The only time those rights and guarantees matter are when times are tough.
Well, times are tough.
And if you can't guarantee it then, what the hell is that society? I mean, I feel that America and Canada failed the test miserably after Pearl Harbor.
They failed the test after 9/11 too then.
Absolutely.
Now, to some extent, Canada has awakened to that failure and tried to rectify it in part in a way that the United States hasn't.
Well, actually, Ronald Reagan did give a settlement and an apology to the Japanese-American people. And our Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, really copied Ronald Reagan. The apology came to Japanese Canadians as well with a financial settlement. But, you know, I didn't accept the money right up until the very last minute, because I thought, you know, you don't just pay off money. No amount of money is going to rectify what was done. And I'm not going to be given a cash settlement and then essentially told to shut up and not say anything. In the end, I did take the money because I said, what the hell, I'll give that money to a cause I believe in, which was First Nations issues in British Columbia.
How much money was it?
It's $20,000 Canadian.
But there's no stipulation that you shut up.
No. They didn't do what I felt was really the important thing. We have an iniquitous act called the War Measures Act, which essentially allows the government in times of stress to suspend all rights, all civil liberties. And I felt that that is a denial of what a democracy is about. And so I felt that the gesture towards Japanese Canadians would have been to rescind that act, but they didn't.
Bringing it up to the present with a violation of rights here in the United States after 9/11, and Canada mimics some of the U.S. laws, but has now rescinded, I think, one of the more severe ones on the curtailment of civil liberties. How do you assess the way both countries dealt with the crisis of 9/11?
Well, of course, 9/11 wasn't the crisis for Canada. What it was a crisis of our biggest trading partner and our nearest neighbor. I was astounded by the response in Canada to that event. Within 2 days of 9/11, tens of thousands of Canadians gathered in Ottawa in front of the American embassy to show our solidarity, our pain, and our support for the United States. It was an amazing moment. And in the weeks that followed, literally millions and millions of dollars poured out of Canadian pockets into the United States. So, you know, there was I think America at that moment had just the whole world behind the country. And for me, the great shock was when Bush got up in Congress and began to list his thanks to the various countries that had shown support and left Canada out. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how hurt Canadians felt, because the response of Canadians was immediate, visceral, and profound. And we always feel that we are America's best friend. And to be slapped in the face by being ignored was... that was a very painful thing for us. But in the months that followed, I think Canada really saw itself very, very distinct from the United States. There was that moment of solidarity, but the direction that the United States went was very different from what Canadians chose. Canadians chose not to go into Iraq. They said, look, we will follow what the United Nations will do. And there was enormous pressure on Chrétien to follow the United States. Canada, despite enormous pressure from Bush, ratified the Kyoto Protocol in 2002. The differences between Canada and the United States came out in large part, I think, as a result of 9/11.
I'm speaking with David Suzuki. You're listening to Progressive Radio. David Suzuki has an autobiography out. He is the longtime host of the Canadian TV show The Nature of Things with David Suzuki. The Arar case, the case of this Canadian citizen who was born in Syria and then was made the unfortunate stop in New York and then was kidnapped, but also the Canadians
the
had
Canadians,
some involvement.
In fact, were behind that whole thing. Gave some kind of information to American authorities and then did nothing in order to prevent him from being deported and ultimately being tortured in another country, and then attempted to deny it in the months and months that followed. Now, there has been a settlement. The Canadian government has apologized, and he, I think, received between 10 and 20 million as a settlement. I don't know how you ever pay money and replace what was done to him, but...
But for the record, the United States hasn't given us an apology, much less a
single dime. Well, the Americans still won't let him in because he's down as one of those suspects, despite all of the evidence that he was just an innocent victim. This is a terrible time right now, and you know, I have begun to really cut back on coming down to the States because it pains me to see what happens at immigration. I mean, I was behind a guy. Where was I? In Los Angeles, coming in from Japan. And he was dark skinned. I mean, he was from the Middle East. Some that guy got hung up at customs long after I collected my baggage and got out of there. He was still hung up. I don't know. It's a terrible time right now.
Let's get into your background a little bit. You were trained as a biologist, a geneticist. You got your PhD, and then you become a TV star. How did that happen?
Well, that was totally accidental. My father, you see, believed that. One of the great impediments of Japanese or, well, Asian Canadians was that we're a very self-effacing people. You know, we're very shy. And it always used to upset him when someone would be asked to say something and they'd kind of stumble around. And he said, you know, if you're going to succeed in Canada, you've got to be able to get up on your feet and speak. And so from childhood on, used to be oratorical contests in Canada, and he made me enter, and then he trained me how to be a public speaker. And it was the most painful thing. You know, I would have to write out my speech longhand, and every night after dinner, down in the basement, and I'd have to orate to him. So I'd give my speech. If I stumbled, I'd have to start at the beginning. He might stop me and say, okay, now this is a very important point. So as you come up to it, you have to slow down and then emphasize it, you know, by either stressing it or, and then I'd have to start at the beginning. Or he might say, stop, that's an important word. So use your hand and gesture to show the importance of that word. So by the end of the evening, every night, I'd be weeping in rage and frustration at this thing. But you could have waked me up at 4 in the morning and said, start your speech, and I would have given it perfectly. I won a lot of oratorical contests, and I credit my father for that ability. And it has certainly helped me as a teacher, which I always regard as my first profession. And when I got my first grown-up job at a university in 1962, it happened that there was a television program the university ran on a community channel called Your University Speaks. And I'm sure it had about 10 people watching it on a Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. And anyway, someone heard that I was a good teacher and asked me to give a talk, and I did, and they loved it. And I ended up doing 8 programs. And that's it. When I started doing those shows, I would come on campus and people would stop me and say, hey, I watched your show the other day. Well, I thought it was great. And I was stunned. I said, what the hell are you doing watching television at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning? Like, I had never owned a TV set. We didn't have a TV set when I went away to college. So TV was a very recent acquisition in my home. And to realize people were watching this medium all hours of the day, I thought, wow, this is a very powerful medium for education. So that was the beginning.
And yet you seem ambivalent about TV, even though you've been in the medium now for more than 40 years. There's a passage in your autobiography where you're asked, I think this is even back in the 1970s, if what the world would be like in 100 years, and you said, if there's still humans around, they'll curse us for two things, nuclear weapons and TV. Why the curse of TV?
Well, I said to him, you know, you've just asked me a very profound question. What do you think the world will be like in 100 years? And he didn't take the bait where I said, if we're around, which I thought was the most provocative thing that I answered there. But I said, if I said to you, gee, Bob, that's a tough question. I'll have to think about that. And didn't say another word for 10 seconds. I said, you would cut away to a commercial within 3 seconds because television has no room for profundity. It's all about instant response. And boy, you know, thinking back, that was a long time ago, almost 40 years ago. And what a profound answer, I thought.
I mean, TV does put an emphasis, so does radio, I suppose, on the glib.
But increasingly so. This is the thing. I gave that answer to Bob McLean in the early 1970s. But that was back when Canada only had about 3 channels. Now, every city in Canada has cable, and lots of people have satellite. You literally can choose from dozens and dozens of channels. So what happens is people surf across the network with a remote control. They're going to stop on you for maybe 2 seconds. Looking at my daughter do a channel surf, my God, it's like I haven't even decided what the show's about, and she's off on another show. And that means that in order to keep the audience, when they click onto you, you have to reach out, grab them by the throat, and say, don't you dare shift channels. Well, how do you do that? You shout. You're more sensational. You're more violent. You're more sexy. It's not an accident that the last big ratings that we got was a show called Fallacies, spelled P-H-A-L-L, about the penis. And I knew that would get blockbuster ratings, and it did.
I saw the picture in your book.
That was just a promotion, but yeah.
Listen, I'm not going to let you get off the hook then on the profound aspect of that answer you gave in the 70s, which is, are human beings going to be around in 100 years?
Well, it's really very difficult to say. All I can say is that we are now at a moment in history which my daughter calls the most exciting time to be alive, because what you've got is a confluence of a number of issues that scientists have been warning about for over 40 years. They're all coming together, and now we're going to have to make decisions now. If we don't make the right decisions now, we're going to determine the future of humanity and God knows how many species of plants and animals. We're at that moment. We've already started a major, major experiment with the planet. That is, we've added over 30% more greenhouse gas to the atmosphere than there was 150 years ago. But we seem determined to more than double that before the end of this century. And if we carry on that trajectory, all indications are we're going to really pull apart the stability of the atmosphere that determines weather and climate, and God knows what the results of that are going to be.
David Suzuki, you've called yourself a Cassandra or a Chicken Little. You've been warning about this now for, well, it's been 19 years since you did a series called It's a Matter of Survival. Are you surprised that more hasn't been done?
Well, I'm very disappointed because when I did It's a Matter of Survival, that program ran in 1989. The environment was at the absolute top of the agenda. I don't know if you remember, but in 1988, a guy ran for president of the United States, and he said, if you vote for me, I promise I'll be an environmental president. Do you know who that was?
Well, I remember reading in the book, George Bush Sr. I was around.
George H.W. Bush. The only reason he said that was because the American public had put it at the top of the agenda. Now, in 88, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney was reelected, and to show that he cared about the environment, he put the brightest star, a man named Lucien Bouchard, as a minister of the environment, and raised the ministry into the inner cabinet. And I interviewed Bouchard from this series, It's a Matter of Survival. I said, "What have you found as the most important issue we face?" And right away, he said, "Global warming." Well, I was very impressed. I said, "How serious is it?" And these are his exact words. It threatens the survival of our species. If we don't do something now, we're in deep trouble. And that same year, in 1988, Brian Mulroney appointed Stephen Lewis, a very eminent politician in Canada, to head up a committee, or to be the chair of an atmosphere conference in Toronto. 300 atmosphere scientists from around the world met in Toronto. And they were so concerned about global warming, they issued a statement saying, "Global warming represents a threat to humanity second only to all-out nuclear war." And they called for a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 20% in 15 years. So here we were in 1988, environment at the absolute top of the agenda. We had a minister of the environment saying it threatens our survival of our species. We had scientists saying we've got to aim for a 20% cut in 15 years. If we had done that, if we had taken it seriously, we would be so far past the Kyoto targets, well on our way to the really deep reductions we need. So to me, the fact that in Canada now, the climate change has rocketed to the absolute number one position is a very bittersweet moment. It's sweet that it is there, but it's so bitter because we've lost almost 20 years. And that 20 years was lost because the fossil fuel industry poured tens of millions of dollars into supporting a handful of naysayers to create confusion in the minds of the public. The public said, well, the scientists haven't figured it out. The scientists had figured it out in 1988, and we ignored it. Now, my message over the last many years has been that the key to human success, you know, we evolved as a species 150,000 years ago in Africa. And if you imagine what the world was like in 150,000 years ago, there were still mammoths on the planet and saber-toothed tigers and giant moa birds 9 feet tall. When humans arose in the Serengeti, we were not a very impressive creature. I mean, think of all the other animals in numbers and size and speed. And you know, look at us. We're wearing glasses. We got crummy vision. We got poor hearing, poor sense of smell. What the hell did we have going for us compared to all these other creatures? What animal in only 150,000 years would take over the planet? Well, the animal had one key thing going, a brain, a big brain. And that brain endowed us with the capacity to create an idea no other creature has. We invented the idea of a future. The future doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is now and our memory of what happened in the past. But because we invented the idea of a future, we are the only animal that realized we can affect the future by what we do today. If we look ahead, see where the dangers lie, see where the opportunities are, we can deliberately choose a path today and avoid the dangers and exploit the opportunities. So foresight is the very definition of what it is to be human. That was the key survival strategy of our species. And it got us to where we've become the dominant animal on the planet. And now we've got all of the amplified brain power and predictive capacity of computers and engineers and scientists and telecommunication. And for over 40 years, they have been telling us we're headed down a dangerous path. And now, at this critical moment, we're turning our backs on the very survival strategy of our species.
I'm speaking with David Suzuki. You're listening to him rail about our lack of foresight.
Sorry, I am railing. I'll stop
that's
railing.
No, rail away. That's what the show's for. It's called Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. We're in the railing business. So that's not a problem. I mean, the Bush administration is willfully not using foresight on the environment.
Well, what the Bush administration is doing is so humiliating to me as a scientist. You see, for over 10 years, the National Academy of Science, this is the leading body of scientists in the world. These are the top scientists in America, have been saying global warming is real. Humans are at the base of it. We've got to act. To take the most distinguished group of scientists and then deny the reality of what they're saying by telling them, I don't believe you, is the biggest slap in the face of the scientific community. I mean, it's an affront. What are we left with? If the scientists are not our best warning of what lies ahead, what do we look to? The Bible? Is this what we're going to do? I mean, is this what we've reverted to now? It's a horrifying situation. The most powerful forces shaping our lives today are the ideas and inventions that come out of science. We have a president, you have a two-term president, who talks about going to Mars. You know, he doesn't have a clue what it's going to take to go to Mars. If he seriously thinks we're going to go to Mars in the next 10 or 15 years, he doesn't know what science is all about. And yet this guy will blithely just deny the reality of climate change, and yet he's going to talk about a space defense mechanism and all this crap that's going on. He doesn't understand science. Unfortunately, I think what he is a reflection of the fact that we as North Americans basically are scientifically illiterate. Back in the 70s, I did a survey of members of parliament in Ottawa. These are comparable to your senators or congressmen and women. And we found 70% of our members of parliament came from two areas. They came from business and they came from law. Well, I happen to think that's very dangerous, because your profession skews the way you look at the world. You know, I always tell people I'm a geneticist. When I'm in a crowd of more than 20 people, I see mutants everywhere. I can't help it. You know, my brain just acts like a geneticist. Well, business people and lawyers, they see the world through, you know, their litigious or economic mindset. But then I administered a simple test for comprehension of science and technology terms and concepts. And guess what? Business people and lawyers, I gave it to 50 members of parliament, business people and lawyers scored absolutely rock bottom. So they make up the bulk of our politicians, and they're going to have to make decisions, informed decisions about stem cells, about global warming, about depletion of marine resources, about deforestation, desertification, artificial intelligence, space travel, blah, blah, blah. And they are incapable of assessing the scientific and technological information they get.
Well, if they're incapable of that, what do we do?
Well, it's a terrifying situation because we are literally out of control of our destiny. Decisions get made for purely political reasons. They're not informed. So to me, the challenge back in the 70s when I did the test was, we've got to make our society scientifically literate. And I was on a committee that sat for four years in Canada, looking at the question of science education in Canada. And we recommended in the end 1 hour of science education every day from K to 12 of every school child's academic career. That is an hour of science every day. Now, we aren't anywhere close to that. We showed that it was economically it could be done, but that's, I think, what we need to do right now. The fact that in America you're still arguing over issues like intelligent design versus evolution. I mean, America's the only industrialized nation where that is a major issue. And I think that's a reflection of scientific illiteracy.
And fundamentalism as well.
Yes.
I'm speaking with David Suzuki, who is the longtime host of the Canadian TV show The Nature of Things with David Suzuki. And he has an autobiography out that I highly recommend. How are we going to not only educate people about science, but, you know, save the world from these catastrophes that you've been warning about? You've studied what motivates people to change their behavior. You're skeptical in this book about the old tactics of demonstrations and protests. What do you recommend?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're asking a total failure. I've been going at this for over 40 years now, and we're going the wrong way. Of course, we never have the control of what the world would be like if there weren't people like me working away. But,
and that's the Howard Zinn argument mostly. I mean, if we weren't doing something, it would be a lot worse.
Well, in the end, what it comes down to is I recognize I'm not. Who the hell do I think I am anyway? I'm one person. I'm not going to save the world or change directions. It is a terrible conceit, and it would be frightening to think any one person could do that. My foundation is a tiny organization. We're not going to get counted to change directions. But if there are millions and millions of insignificant people like me and hundreds of thousands of organizations, I think that could be an irresistible force. How do we go about doing it? Well, I'm afraid that we respond most strikingly to crisis. And certainly it was quite striking to me after Katrina hit, when I come down to the States, it was the first time I began to encounter people saying, gee, do you think this has got to do with global warming? Up until that time, I found there was no interest in global warming. And here's where there's quite a contrast between Canada and the United States. In Canada, global warming has become the number one issue. All of the polls indicate that over the last 6 months. And I think part of it is because we're seeing it happen much more strikingly in the Arctic. One of the iconic species in Canada is a polar bear, and we know that it's threatened. Inuit in the Arctic have been telling us now for years. We're seeing our northern forest turn red because they're being killed by pine beetles that are no longer killed because the winters aren't cold enough. We're seeing freak storms. I mean, lots of things have happened that have really raised the consciousness. And thank God for Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. That had a huge impact in Canada because we were ready for it at that point. So a number of things have happened to raise the issue. I think that more crises are going to be necessary for Americans to wake up. You still have an incredibly powerful lobby, the fossil fuel industry. Thank goodness Arnold Schwarzenegger is saying we've got to get on with it. Over 300 mayors of cities in the United States are committed to meeting the Kyoto target. So all kinds of things are happening in spite of the Bush administration. And I think when he's gone, there's going to be a seismic shift, and we're going to see the forces marshaled. Now, what I would love to, if you don't mind, when I was a senior in college in the fall of 1957, and on October 4th, we were electrified to hear that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik. We had no idea there was a space program. And in the months that followed, the United States Navy and Army and Air Force all tried to launch their rockets, failed miserably, blew up on the launch pads, got off the ground, blew up. I'm sorry, am I running out of space? Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is that America didn't roll over and say, oh my God, the Russians are too far advanced. We can't afford to put the money into it. The Russians put the first dog in space, the first man, the first woman, the first. America just said, we've got to beat these guys, and committed the effort to doing it. And look at what happened. They beat the Russians to the moon. They, all of the technology of telephones, your cell phones and CNN and all that stuff, no one anticipated that when the space race started. And in 2006, America won every single Nobel Prize in science. And that's because America said, we've got no choice. We've got to commit and win this thing. And so I think it's un-American for America to say we can't do anything about global warming.
We're going to have to end it there. A space program, not to Mars, but to solve this global warming problem. David Suzuki, thanks so much for being my guest today. His foundation is the David Suzuki Foundation. You can find it at davidsuzuki.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.